This is podcast number 110 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm talking about Robert Louis Stevenson. I had intended on devoting a podcast to Robert Louis Stevenson in month two, when we talk about pirates, because he, of course, is the author of the most popular pirate book ever written, Treasure Island. He's the originator of 15 Men on a Dead Man's Chest, Yo-Ho-Ho and a Bottle of Rum. I could have also placed his story in month one when we talk about the South Seas because of what he did there among the Samoans. Or we could talk about him in month five when we talk about poetry in the Mother's University because he wrote the much-beloved A Child's Garden of Verses. Or I could talk about him in month six where we talk about storytelling. The native Samoans called him Tusitala, a teller of tales. His stories endeared himself to them. But here we are in month three, and this is where I will start, because Edinburgh, Scotland, is where he was born and raised, in a family of lighthouse builders. I think I'll tell you his story by starting at the end, and when you hear, you will understand why I love this great author so much. Stevenson was sickly his whole life. The cold, damp climate of Scotland was especially hard on him, and it was for health reasons that he sailed to the warm, sunny islands of Samoa, where he busied himself not only with creating a home for his family, but in caring for the islanders he quickly came to love with all his heart. And oh, how they loved him! I'm going to share a couple of sections from Amy Cruz's biography of Robert Louis Stevenson to demonstrate that love. The first scene follows an incident when several of the tribal chiefs who had been imprisoned were openly befriended by Stevenson at his own personal risk. Almost as soon as they were released from prison in September 1894, nine of them came up to Valima for a consultation. Valima was Stevenson's home. They sat in a solemn circle on the floor of the hall and made known their intentions to Stevenson and his assembled family. He had, they said, done much to improve their position in prison and to hasten their release, and they had been considering what they could do in return. They had decided to make, with their own hands and the hands of their families, a road from the house at Valima as far as the public way to Apia, to bear all charges and to supply their own food while the work was going on. Mrs. Strong describes how the talking man of the party began with the usual formal expressions and the usual Samoan composure of countenance. But when he began to speak of the love and gratitude they bore to Tusitala, of how they prayed for him and cherished the memory of his kindness, his calmness broke down, and he spoke with strong and real emotion. The whole incident touched Stevenson very deeply. Road-making was one of the most detested tasks of any of the whole island, and it was difficult to find men who, either for the desire of high wages or the fear of punishment, would undertake it. But the chiefs entered on their task with the heartiest goodwill and good humor. In a few weeks, the road was finished, and was known henceforward as Ala Loto Alagfa, the Road of the Loving Heart. When it was finished, Stevenson invited all the workers and their families to a feast and made to them a speech that embodies all his feeling for Samoa and his ideals and hopes for its future. "I love the land," he said. "I have chosen it to be my home while I live, and my grave after I am dead. And I love the people, and have chosen them to be my people, to live and die with." And now for the final scene of his life, the end of the story. Monday, the third day of the month, was mail day, and all the afternoon Stevenson was occupied in writing letters to his friends at home. When at sunset he joined the rest of the family on the veranda, he was in the gayest spirits. He talked over plans for the future, and especially about a lecturing tour in America that he was eager to make. He joked with his wife, who had all day been oppressed by a presentiment of coming evil, and drew her to join with him in preparations for making of their evening meal a little festival. Suddenly he put both hands to his head and cried out, "What's that?" And then quickly, "Do I look strange?" and fell on his knees before his wife. Sosimo, His faithful attendant came running in and helped Mrs. Stevenson to carry him into the great hall and put him into the armchair, where he lay unconscious, but breathing heavily. Doctors were hurriedly sent for, and two soon arrived. Everything their knowledge and skill could suggest was done, but with no avail. The master of the house, the center and mainspring of all its activities, was dying. Loving hands lifted the unconscious form and laid it gently on a bed that had been brought in and placed in the middle of the hall. As the dire news spread over the estate, awe-stricken native servants stole silently in and seated themselves in a wide semicircle on the floor, their dark, anxious faces all turned toward their chief, the well-loved Tusitala. His wife and other members of his family gathered in anguish around his bed, and his missionary friend, Mr. Clark, who had come hurrying to Valima at the news of the attack, knelt and prayed aloud. The deep, painful breaths grew slower and fainter, then ceased. Robert Louis Stevenson was dead. Silently, his native servants went about the last sad duties they owed to their dead chief, the great Union Jack that his loyal heart had loved to see floating over the walls he had built in a strange land was hauled down and placed over his body. And under that symbol of home, the Scotsman who was no more an exile lay at rest. His servants each knelt and reverently kissed the dead hand of their master. Not one could be induced to take any rest all through that long, sad night. There was no loud lamentation, but their mournful faces and dejected bearing showed how heavily this loss had fallen upon them. They sat silent, or chanted in a mixture of Latin and Samoan the long, solemn prayers that the Romish Church has ordained for use in the chamber of death, till the dawn came and brought in the day on which Tusitala must be laid in the grave. Many feet trod that morning the road of the loving heart, and chief after chief brought the customary offering of a fine mat to lay upon the body of the dead. Flowers, too, were brought, brilliant tropical flowers that filled the great hall with a blaze of color. An old Matafa chief, one of those who had been in prison, and who had afterward helped in building the road, came among the others, and as he crouched beside the dead body of Tusitala, he lamented over him in touching words. "I am only a poor Samoan and ignorant," he said. "Others are rich and can give Tusitala the parting presents of rich, fine mats. I am poor and can give nothing this last day he receives his friends. Yet I am not afraid to come and look the last time in my friend's face, never to see him more till we meet with God. We were in prison, and he cared for us. We were sick, and he made us well. We were hungry, and he fed us. The day was no longer than his kindness. You are great people and full of love, yet who among you is so great as Tusitala? What is your love to his love?" Near at hand, the grave was being prepared. Stevenson was to be buried in the place that he himself had chosen when he knew that he could not be laid with his fathers, in the bleak Scotch graveyard at home. On the top of Veia, there is a small tableland no larger than a room, and here was to be his resting place. No path led to the steep side of the mountain, so 40 of those who had gathered to offer their services were sent to hew one out with knives and axes, while a band of the Valima servants, headed by Lloyd Osborne, dug the grave on the summit. The coffin, quickly made by the skillful hands of an old friend, was ready by noon, and so Samo reverently placed the body of his master within it, posing the dead hands in the attitude of prayer. Then the tattered red ensign that had gone with him in the South Sea voyagings was laid upon the coffin, and it was borne on the shoulders of powerful Samoans up the steep path to the mountaintop. The ascent was a work of almost incredible labor and difficulty, and each slow and painful step that brought them nearer to the summit tried most severely the strength of the devoted bearers. And there, on the top of the mountain that had guarded his home, Robert Louis Stevenson was laid to rest. His grave is marked by a tomb built in Samoan fashion of great blocks of cement. On either side is a bronze plate. One bears in Samoan the words, "The tomb of Tusitala. Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried." On the other plate is written in English two verses from his own requiem, with his name and the date of his birth and his death. Robert Louis Stevenson. Under the wide and starry sky, dig the grave and let me lie. Glad did I live and gladly die, and I laid me down with a will. This be the verse you grave for me. Here he lies where he longed to be. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter home from the hill. He was just 44 years old when he died, but what a lot of life he crammed into those short years. And so my question, I wondered, was, what was the childhood that created such a loving heart? For a glimpse of that, I'll turn to a story found in Stories of Great Writers. What luck it is to have a lamp before our very own door, thought little Louis Stevenson as he stood by the nursery window to watch for the lamplighter. One by one, the lamps along Howard Place were touched into points of light until the lamplighter reached number 8, and then came the crowning joy of all when Leary stopped to light that special lamp. Would he look up and see the small face pressed against the window and nod good evening, or would he be too busy to think of little boys? It was no wonder that the coming of the lamplighter was so eagerly looked for. The winter days were often long and wearisome to the little child shut up in the nursery there, and everything he could see from his window was interesting and exciting. Louis, or Smout as his father called him, was so often ill and caught cold so easily in the bitter cold Edinburgh winds that he was often kept indoors the whole winter through, and all that he saw of the outside world was through his nursery window. They were happy days indeed, when he was well enough to play about the nursery, to lie flat on the floor chalking and painting his pictures, and to watch for Leary when the gloaming came. But there were many other days spent in bed, when Louis was obliged to make believe a good deal to keep himself happy, as he sat up with a little shawl pinned around his shoulders and his toys arranged on the counterpane beside him. It was all very well to make believe in the daytime, when he could drill his soldiers and sail his ships and build his cities on the pleasant land of counterpane. But when night came on, it was weary work to lie long hours awake with a cough that hurt, dreaming half-waking dreams of wild terrors that were worst of all. The wintry winds shrieked as they swept past, thumping at the window and howling away into the distance, and they sounded to the shivering child like a horseman galloping up into the town, thundering past with jingling spurs and fearful haste on some dreadful errand, only to turn and gallop back again with the same mysterious haste. Louis, in his little bed, shaken with terrified sobs, said his prayers over and over again, and longed for the morning to come. It was so difficult to be brave when the night was so dark and he was so full of aches and pains. But there was always someone at hand ready to comfort the child through those long, dreadful hours. His nurse, Alison Cunningham, Cummy as he called her, never failed him. She was always there to drive away the terrors and soothe the pain, always patient and always gentle with the poor little weary boy. His nurseries changed first to Inverleith Row and then to number 17 Harriet Row, but Cummy was always there. She was his sure refuge from terrors at night and the sharer of his joys by day. The feeling of her most comfortable hand he never forgot. Sometimes on those long, watchful nights, when his wide-open eyes began to see fearful shapes, he would ask, "Why is the room so gaunt and great? Why am I lying awake so late?" She would wrap a blanket round him and carry him over to the window, where he could look across the dark trees of the gardens beneath and see a few lights shining in the windows of the houses in Queen Street opposite. Safe in her arms, no shadows could touch him, and together they gravely discussed the question as to whether the lights meant that another wee laddie was awake watching with his nurse for the morn to come. "When will the carts come in?" was the question always on his lips those weary nights, for the coming of the carts always meant that daybreak was at hand, and the world was astir once more. out in the city sounds begin. Thank the kind God, the carts come in. An hour or two more, and God is so kind. The day shall be blue and the window blind. But it was not only Cummy who watched over and cared for little Louis. There were his father and his mother, too. Often during the night, the nursery door would open gently, and his father would come in and sit by his bedside and tell him story after story, until the child forgot his pain and weariness and drifted away into the land of dreams. His father's tales always had a special charm for him and helped him through one terrible hour which he never forgot. He had been left alone in a room and by mistake had locked himself in and then was unable to unlock the door. Evening was coming on. All his terrors of the dark began to gather round as the shadows crept nearer. All the wicked shadows coming tramp, tramp, tramp with the black night overhead. But his father was close at hand, and his voice came through the keyhole talking about such delightful, interesting things that Louis held his breath to listen and quite forgot the shadows and the darkness until the locksmith arrived to open the door. Then there was his young mother, my jewels of mothers, as he called her, who was so ready to play with him and who always made even the dull nursery a sunshiny, happy place. She was not very strong, and Louis began early to try to take care of her. One day when he was only 3 years old, he was left alone with her after dinner and remembered that Cummy always wrapped a shawl about her. There was no shawl to be found, but he reached up and took a doily off the table, carefully unfolded it, and spread it over as much of her as it would cover. "There's a wee bitty, Mama," he said comfortingly. Cummy was very strict about Sunday, but his jewelest of mothers had a way of overcoming the difficulty, and if he promised to play nothing but the Pilgrim Progress game, she sewed a patch on the back of one of the wooden figures, and lo, there was Christian, ready to flee from the city of destruction with all his exciting adventures ahead. There was, of course, the shorter catechism to be learned, and there was no way of avoiding that. But afterwards came long chapters out of the Bible, which Louis loved to listen to, and Cummy would read parts of the old writings of the Covenanters, and everything she read to him she managed to make most interesting. Louis himself learned to repeat long passages out of the Bible, besides psalms and hymns, and he always recited them with a great deal of action, his small hands scarcely ever still, and his dark eyes shining with excitement. With Mother and Cummy to amuse him all day long, he was rather like a small prince in the nursery, and it was his will and pleasure that someone should constantly read to him. He never could listen quietly to any story, but must always try to act it, slaying dragons, attacking the enemy, galloping off on a fiery horse to carry news to the enemy until he was tired out, and Cummy would smooth back the hair from his hot forehead and try to persuade him to rest. "Sit down and bide quiet for a bitty," she said, and then coaxed him to sew a piece of his kettle holder or knit the garter that was as black as only a child's grimy little hands could make it. When spring came, it brought new life to little Louis, and the long nights of pain and cold winter days were forgotten as he played about the garden of his grandfather's manse at Collington. Like the flowers, he began to lift up his head and grow strong in the sunshine. It was a different world to him when the sun shone and the sky was blue and the splendid colors of the flowers made his days a rainbow ride of delight. There was no more lying in his bed, no more coughs and wakeful nights, but instead long warm summer days spent in the garden or down by the river where there was the joy of Louis's heart, a mill. There were cousins there too in the sunny garden, ready to play all the games that Louis invented, to lie behind the bushes with toy guns watching for a drove of antelopes to go by, to be shipwrecked sailors on a desert island where the only food to be had to keep them from starvation was buttercups, and even to eat those buttercups and suffer the after effects rather than spoil the pretending game. It was not until Louis was 8 years old that he began to read. His mother and Cummy had always been ready to read to him, and that, he thought, was the pleasanter way. But quite suddenly he discovered that it was good to be able to read stories to himself, and it was a red-letter day when he first got possession of the Arabian Nights. Long before he could write, He was fond of dictating stories to anyone who would write them for him, and poor patient Cummy would write sheet after sheet of nonsense, all of which she treasured and read to his mother afterwards. Sitting over the fire at night while Lewis lay sleeping in his little bed, the mother and nurse whispered together over the cleverness of their boy, and anxiously tried to reassure each other that he was growing stronger, while they built their castles in the air, always for Lewis to dwell in as king. Lewis's school days made but little impression upon him. He was so often kept away by ill health, and the schools were so often changed that he never won many laurels there. Whatever he liked to learn, he learned with all his heart, and to the rest he gave very little attention whatever. He was not very fond of games, for he was not strong enough to play them well, and it was only when the make-believe magic began that he was in his element. He played football, but had to invent a tale of enchantment which changed the ball into a talisman and the players into two Arabian nations before he could enjoy it. Far more exciting than any football was the business of being a lantern-bearer, that game of games which he described with his magic pen long afterwards. Picture Lewis stealing out of the house at North Berwick on a late September evening, his overcoat buttoned up tightly over something that bulged at his waist, his very walk beckoning an errand of mystery. Presently, coming over the wind-swept shore, another dark figure is seen, also with a buttoned-up overcoat and the same kind of bulge at the waist. "Have you got your lantern?" breathed Lewis. "Yes," comes the answer. "All is well." Over the links and away to the shore, the mysterious figures wend their way and are joined by others equally mysterious. And one by one, they climb into an old boat and crouch together there at the bottom. The wind whistles and shrieks overhead, but down there they are sheltered, and the overcoats are slowly and carefully unbuttoned, and what seemed to be but a bulge is shown to be a tin lantern burning brightly, which accounts for the strong smell of toasting tin which has been hanging in the air about them. In the dim light of these lanterns, the lantern bearers sit, and wild and exciting is the talk that mingles with the shriek of the wind, while the sky is black overhead and the sound of the sea is in their ears. No one can talk as Lewis does. He lays a spell upon them all with his make-believe magic. But after all, it is not the talk that is so fascinating, but rather the buttoning up of those overcoats over the lighted lanterns, the exquisite joy of knowing that unseen and unsuspected, a hidden light is burning brightly there. That was the joy of being a lantern bearer. So it was that the make-believe magic kept Lewis happy in his childhood's games, and when he grew up to be a man and left the games behind him, the make-believe magic was never left behind, but gave a great happiness to the world as well as to himself. "Be good and make others happy," was his own particular rule, for he believed that everyone should be as happy as ever they could, and even children should remember that the world is so full of a number of things, I'm sure we should all be as happy as kings. There's so many other things I'd love to tell you about Robert Louis Stevenson, but I'll let you discover them on your own. But did you notice? Once again, we see stories, songs, rhymes, pictures, imaginative play, and nature wrapped in love are the secret ingredients of well-educated and loving hearts. Bye-bye. See you next time.